Good morning, good afternoon. For some of you, it might be good night, depending on where we are in the world. I'm glad to be here with you. My name is Zvi Grummet, and I'm going to be teaching this this mini series. The mini series, basically, the idea is we had yesterday, we had Shivasar b'Tammuz. We're coming up to Tisha B'Av. We are in the period, the saddest, most mournful period of the Jewish calendar. And I thought it would be valuable for us to take a look at some of the texts that that actually accompany us during this period, and specifically the texts that we use on Tisha B'Av. I recall, by the way, I heard Rav Soloveitchik once speaking about Kinot on Tisha B'Av. I heard Rabbi J.J. Schachter many, many times talking about the keynote on Tisha B'Av. And one of the things he cited in the name of Rav Soloveitchik was that Rav Soloveitchik lauded the fact that keynote were printed on flimsy paper that is not meant to last more than 1 year. That because, and every year they would take it and they would put it into Geniza. And the following year they would go and dig it out of Geniza and reuse it. And over the course of the last 40 years, there have been 40 to 50 years, that has changed. We now have many publications, beautiful hardcover publications with commentaries on the keynote and on Echa, including at least one of Rav Soloveitchik's own interpretations. I'm not sure how happy he would be about that. But here we are, we're preparing. We hope that all this preparation will be good as a history lesson, but we're preparing for the text that we're going to be handling and reciting on Tisha B'Av itself. And particularly what I wanted to look at is the texts are for the most part quite difficult. They're poetry. Poetry, I always have a hard time with, and many people have a hard time with poetry. There are poetry with lots of allusions to all sorts of things, using a lot of poetic tools. It's very powerful. And yet it's difficult, especially since, in many, if not most of the shuls where they're recited, they're actually recited fairly quickly. People talk about them, but they don't actually learn them. So what I thought we would do in this series is we have three parts. In the first part today, we're going to take a look at one perek from Megillat Echa, and look at and specifically at the poetry that Yirmiyahu HaNavi used in writing the first perek of Megillat Echa. The second session next week, same time, same channel. We're going to take a look at the keynote that we recite at night on Tisha B'Av. There's a very limited selection, and we're going to take a look at I think two of the keynote that we recite on at night on Tisha B'Av, and again looking specifically with an eye toward the poetry, and then the final session, which will be in the week leading up to Tisha B'Av, we'll take a look at a few of the keynote that we recite in the morning, and again looking specifically at the poetry and how the authors use poetry and develop their ideas. So that's the plan for these three sessions. With no further ado, I'm going to jump right in. I will save some time at the end for questions. So if you want to put questions into the chat, that will be fine, but I'm only going to look at them at the end, toward the end of the session, and then that way we can really have an opportunity to learn, and then we can take a look at the questions. My understanding was, did you all get a source sheets? Okay, so some of you did not, and some of you may have. I don't know. I sent them in. I don't know who got it, who didn't get. Any kind of source sheets for today's session, I'm going to put up on the screen. So you're going to see very little of my face. We're going to be working with the text of the with the text of Megillat Eicha today, and specifically the first parak of Megillat Eicha. And I think I would start just by pointing out something that I heard from Rav Soloveitchik, who I might have, over the course of the years, my memory might have been altered by my own insertions in there. So if there's something you don't like, you can probably blame me for it. And otherwise, Rav Soloveitchik takes the credit for the ideas. Many of us know that Megillat Eicha, the first four prakim of Megillat Eicha, are written with an aleph bet. A very clear structure. Perek aleph is aleph bet, 22 psukim. Perek bet is an aleph bet, 22 psukim. Perek gimel is actually a triple aleph bet, so it has 66 psukim. I mean, there are three psukim that start with aleph, and three psukim that start with bet, and three. And then perek dalet is again an aleph bet, 22 psukim. Perek He breaks that. Perek He has 22 psukim, but it doesn't follow the aleph bet. It doesn't seem to be an artificial acrostic that ties them together. Anybody who's ever written poetry or has ever written anything knows that when you limit yourself with an acrostic, it actually makes the writing more difficult, because whatever you have to say, you're going to have to twist it in order to fit the next letter that's coming up in the alphabet. And the question that I ask myself, that many ask, is why would Yirmiyahu do this intentionally? He didn't have to. In the last parak, he didn't do that. And the other things that we attribute to Yirmiyahu and Avi, he did not die, did not write them with an alphabet. So why would he do that here? And what I understood Rav Soloveitchik saying is that the awesomeness or awfulness of the Churban that Yirmiyahu witnessed and spent a good chunk of his life trying to prevent, it was just so awful that he did not know where to start. And so he started with the letter Aleph. The Aleph Beit gave him an opening. How do I begin? I would add to that in theory, the same thing is true as you're going through once you start and you're witnessing this. I think, in my head of how mute so many of us were after October 7th. We had no clue what to say, no clue how to say it. But once the word started, it was hard to stop. And here we are, 9 months later, 9.5 months later, and it's hard for us to stop. So how do you stop? So on the one hand, the Aleph Beit gave Yirmiyahu the opening to start. And on the other hand, it also gave him an excuse to stop. You hit tough, you can stop. The power of repeating the Aleph Beit six times in Megillat Eicha may be Yirmiyahu's way of saying, I had an opportunity to stop, but I couldn't. So I had to start all over again from the Aleph. Okay? So as much as it's limiting, it actually reveals it, or it could possibly reveal a tremendous amount of what's going on. And what I'd like to do without, with no further delay, I'm going to put up on the screen the source sheet that I prepared for you. And this is what we're going to be looking at for most of the time that we are here. So this is just, the source sheet is very simple. It's Megillat Eicha. Okay, this is actually Perek Aleph of Eicha. And you can see that the first, I highlighted the first letter of each pasuk in yellow to highlight that this is the Aleph base. You've got the Aleph, the Beit, the Gimel, the Dalet, as we go on, from Aleph all the way through Tav. But here, there's something really interesting that happens. Okay? Because if I had to use the Aleph Beit, I would be struggling always to figure out how do I start that next sentence? And here, Yirmiyahu leaves clues to us that he had no difficulty finding his next letters. I just want to show you a few examples of this. I'm looking here at Pasuk Beit. And there's a word here in Pasuk Beit towards the end of the Pasuk. I'm just going to highlight it for a minute. Right now it appears in red. I'm just going to highlight that for a minute with a blue highlighter. And we have a word, bagdu. Okay, so this is an interesting word. This is in the Beit Pasuk. Okay, and this word tells us I have my letters already. Beit Gimel Dalet. Bagdu. The Beit Gimel Dalet. I have my next letters ready. Okay, it's not the only time this happens. Actually, it happens quite a number of times in this parak. I'm going to jump down a few psukim to the Hey Pasuk. Hayu. Okay? Easy to follow. And if you look in the middle of that pasuk, again, we have an interesting word. The word, I don't think it appears anywhere else in Tanakh. Hoga. Right? Hoga means he made her sad. But the Hoga, this is the Hey Pasuk, he's got his Vav waiting for him. I'm going to jump down another three psukim to the Chet Pasuk. And here he does it to us twice. He's in the Chet Pasuk, and the word he chooses already has the Tet is ready. Chet Chata. He does it twice. Jump down two more psukim, and this one might be a little bit of a stretch. You have in the Yud Pasuk, he has the Kaf and the Lamed ready, that Kol, and as he starts his next Pasuk, the Kaf Pasuk, he uses the Kaf and the Lamed, so the Lamed is already waiting for him. So we have quite a number of examples, and as we go down towards the end of the Perek, we actually see him doing this in other kinds of ways. If you go down to the Pei Pasuk, okay, Perisat Zion. So the first word starts with the Pei, the second one starts with the Tzadi. You know, he's got his next word all lined up, he's got the Tzadi lined up. When you go to the one after that, Tzadik, he's got the Tzadi and the Kuf in that one word. And the next Pasuk, Karati, he's got his Kuf and his Resh. Okay? So it seems like Yirmiyahu, as he's writing this, the Aleph Beit, we would think, might be constraining. But for him, it actually gives him an opening. And he has no lack of words. And I might even suggest, I want to stretch this a little bit more, the very, very last pasuk, right? He starts with a tough, and he ends with that first word starts with a tough and takes him back to Aleph. I mean, he knows he's going back all over again. He's going to start all over again. So the next parak is going to start again with an Aleph, all right? So here we have one example of how he uses this artificial constraint, but within the artificial constraint, he's clearly not constrained at all. He has all the words he needs. He has all the letters lined up and more. What I'd like to do, perhaps, and dig a little bit deeper, is to take a look at some of the other tools, some of the other poetic tools that Yirmiyahu uses over here. And one of the poetic tools that that many of us know about is called personification. When you take an inanimate object, and you describe it in human terms. And then you give voice to that inanimate object by giving voice to the human that that's supposed to represent. And Yirmiyahu does that throughout this parak. In fact, it is dominant in the first half of the parak. We'll speak a little bit more about that later. But very, very prominent in the first half of the parak. The person that Yirmiyahu chooses to identify over here, to personify Yerushalayim with, is an almana. Now, almana in Tanakh, especially when you think about Sefer Dvarim, where probably the word almana comes up very, very frequently. The almana is usually put together with ger, yatom, and almana. And they all have something in common. these are the least protected people in society. The ger has no relatives, certainly halachically has no relatives. He's a stranger, left the relatives behind in some other country, like Ruth, and came and joined the people, and has nobody there protecting her, right? So that's the ger. The yatom, an orphan, right? Clearly we understand why the orphan is somebody who has no protection. And the almana whose husband was the one who, certainly in the ancient world, was the one who served as her protector and provider. And now the almana is weak and vulnerable. So choosing the almana as the image of Yerushalayim is a powerful symbol, drawing on all the times that the Torah tells us how thoughtful we have to be to the ger yatom and almana, how careful we have to be not to mistreat the ger yatom and almana, how cautious we have to be in terms of protecting and taking care of the ger yatom and the almana. And here, Yirmiyahu, right from the opening, compares Yerushalayim to an almana. And what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is actually see how he develops this imagery. So we're going to start. I'm just going to read together with you.
Could you just tell us whether the technique that you ascribe to Eicha is also found in the book of Yirmiyahu, or whether it's unique to Eicha?
You talk about the technique of personification?
This use, the way he uses the alphabet, is it also echoed in the book of Yirmiyahu, or is it unique to Eicha?
So it's not unique to Eicha. In Sefer Yirmiyahu, so Navi there actually does a lot more of the reverse. It uses objects. Uses objects for symbolically. It could be that there is some personification there as well, but here, certainly in Perek Aleph, it stands out as being very prominent.
Does this link provide evidence that Eicha was really written by Yirmiyahu? Because as you know, it's debated.
So let's put the questions into the chat and we'll come to them at the end. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So let's just look through the first few psukim and get a sense of what's happening over here. Eicha yashva badad, right? And the key word over here is badad, the loneliness. The ger yatom almana, they are alone. But not just alone, they're lonely. There's a huge difference between being alone and lonely. A person can be alone but not be lonely. They know that they have lots of people out there. The ger yatom and the almana are badad. They're alone. They're lonely. Eicha yashva badad. Look how she sits all lonely. Who sits like that? Ha'ir, Abati'am, the city that used to be teeming with people. Aita ka'almana. She is like the almana. So he's comparing Yerushalayim here to the almana, and specifically he starts with the loneliness of the almana. The end of the pasuk goes and picks up on one word, the word rabati. Right? The word rabati, which meant had a lot of, I translated it as teeming, the city that used to be teeming with people. And now in the second half of that pasuk, he goes and expands on that rabati. Let me explain to you what I mean. Rabati bagoyim. It was great amongst all the other nations. Sarati bamedinot. It was the princess amongst all the other countries. And now, haitalamas. Now she pays tribute, right? So we have over here the sense. He starts by talking about the loneliness of Yerushalayim, the loneliness of an almana. But now in the second half of the pasuk, as he expands on that rabati, right? He gives his own midrash, as it were, on the word rabati. He actually takes it a step further, because there are lots of different kinds of almanot. And here we have an almana that used to be married to a very, very wealthy man. It used to be Rabati Bagoyim. It used to be Sarati Bamdinot. So it's not just that Yerushalayim sits lonely. Yerushalayim used to be the high society woman. She was the one that everybody looked up to. She was the one who traveled in all the fanciest circles. And now her loneliness is exaggerated. So in the opening pasuk, Yirmiyahu starts by describing Yerushalayim as an almana and closes that opening pasuk by saying, but not just any kind of almana. She's an almana who used to be way, way up there and now has fallen all the way down. You know, we have a halachic concept that there are two words the Torah uses to describe poor people. One of them is an ani, and the other one is evyon. Ani is somebody who's poor. They don't have financial means. Evyon is somebody who used to not be poor and then became poor. That's devastating because it's not only about being able to survive, it actually challenges our entire being, our sense of self-worth. And now with that, we go to the next pasuk. Bacho tivke balayla, she cries at night. Now, why would a high society woman be crying only at night? Presumably because she doesn't want people to see. When she sees other people, right, she puts on a happy face or whatever it is. But at night she's crying, she's trying to protect her own dignity. However, he continues, "Bidim'ata alechia," but her tears are still on her face, meaning she's crying at night to protect her dignity. But in the morning, when she walks out, everybody can see that she's been crying all night. So here we have the almana drop a level. My almana is already like near the bottom of social ranking. The almana who's lost everything is a lower level than that. Lower than that is she can't even protect her dignity because her tears are on her face. Everybody looks at her and they see that she's been crying. Ein la menachem mikol ohaveha. There is no one from all of her friends who is coming to comfort her. And now we get to the end of the pasuk, which again is like a gut punch. Kol re'eha bagduva. All of her friends have betrayed her. Ayula lo'evim. Have become like her enemies. So she walks in the street. She's trying to protect her dignity, but everybody can see that she's got tears on her face. And instead of coming over to put their arms around her shoulders, the people that she relied on the most are all mocking her. Okay, so we start with an almana, which is not really very, a good place to start. And what Yirmiyahu has managed to do here in the first two psukim is take her down a step, and take her down a second step, and take her down a third step. We could continue this, right? There are a couple of other steps that Yirmiyahu goes into. But again, what he does here is incredibly powerful in terms of the personification. I want to skip to Pasuk Dalet. Pasuk Dalet is actually one of my favorite psukim in, if you can say such a thing, in the entire Megillah. Pasuk Dalet, he steps out of, for just a minute, he steps out of the almana imagery, and now he does the personification on a very different kind of level. Because what Yirmiyahu does in Pasuk Dalet, instead of talking about all of Yerushalayim, he begins breaking down different parts of the city. So how do the different parts of the city react? And for this, I'm just going to give a little bit of background. I live in Yerushalayim. I love living in Yerushalayim. It's I dreamt my entire life of being able to say my home in Yerushalayim. It's a great city. Traffic is awful. And no matter what they do to fix it, it just gets worse. There are times when we want to go someplace, and instead of budgeting 15 minutes for a trip, I have to budget 45 minutes for the trip, just to get from one side of town to the other side of town. And it's not a very big city at that. I think of that specifically when, there are times during the year that it gets worse, like when all the tourists come. All of a sudden, traffic is worse. Getting into places, trying to get a seat in a restaurant, everything just becomes that much more complicated and that much more difficult and that much more crowded. I give that as background because that's what Pasuk Dalet is all about. Pasuk Dalet has four clauses in it and a closure. And I would just like to take a look at each of those clauses for a minute. Darchei Tzion avelot mibli ba'ei moed. The roads in Tzion, the roads are mourning. So now it's not Yerushalayim as an almanah. Now the roads, personification of the roads are mourning. Why are the roads mourning? Because there's nobody coming for the chagim. Mibli ba'ei moed. There's nobody, right? The absence of people coming for Shalosh V'dalim. And to understand this, just imagine what the streets are saying to each other or had been saying to each other in the previous years. Oh my goodness, Sukkot is coming up. All these people are going to be trampling all over us. The horses, nobody's going to clean up after them I have to describe to you the kind of mess that they're going to leave over here. And the streets are complaining. But now, the streets are mourning. They would love to have something to complain about. We'd much rather have the horses and the people trampling through us and breaking us up than to be completely desolate. So, Darchei Tzion, the streets of the city are in mourning. Mibli ba'ei moed. Kol sha'areha shomemim. The gates are desolate. I think about this. I have two images in my mind. I don't know how many of you have been in Yerushalayim for Shavuot. There's a beautiful scene that takes place on Shavuot between the night and the morning of Shavuot. You have tens of thousands of people who have been learning in all different corners of Yerushalayim. And about an hour before it's time to start davening, they start leaving their places of learning and they start walking. And if you live in one of the outlying neighborhoods, you'll see a couple of people walking. And as you get closer, right, you begin to see the trickle from one street meeting up with the trickle from another street. And now it's a small stream. And then you get to the next intersection, and that small stream meets together with another stream. And eventually, all of those streams converge. And there are very few places for them to converge into. And you can sometimes wait 10 or 15 minutes just to get through Shaar Yafo. Right? As all these people converge, and you have this, this big, big crowd of people. And then once you get through Shaar Yafo, getting down the stairs going towards the Kotel. Well, the Kotel, now those stairs can only handle a limited number of people, and there's pushing and shoving, and those gates must be crying. Right? Those gates must be saying, I can't believe it, we have it again. I'm getting pushed and shoved in all places. I remember a number of years ago, I was with my family in Dubrovnik. Many people call Dubrovnik the Yerushalayim of Europe. It's a walled city, it's a very beautiful city. It took us about a half hour to get out of the city, just to get through the gate and the crowds there. And I was just afraid of losing my kids or having them get trampled. And what Yirmiyahu does over here, he says, "Wow, Just imagine what those gates were saying on the different Shalosh Regalim. And now there's nobody walking through them. They would much rather have the crowds. Those are the first two clauses in the Pasuk. The third clause brings us to Kohanim. Kohanecha, Kohaneha ne'enachim. Her Kohanim are groaning. Now that groaning, so he's talking about now they're groaning. But just imagine what it was like being a Kohen, for example, on Erev Pesach. When everybody, but literally everybody in the country came to Yerushalayim to do their Korban Pesach. And the Kohanim are sitting there and they have to service hundreds of thousands of people. The Mishnah describes just how difficult the process was. They had to institute all sorts of administrative systems, and there were problems, and those Kohanim dreaded. They dreaded the Chagim. They dreaded Erev Pesach. They dreaded, for example, Simchat Beit HaShoeva and Sukkot. So they worked all day and then they had to work all night. And there's this huge party and nobody cleans up after themselves. And the Kohanim are there all day and all night doing, I don't know, 12-hour shifts or whatever it is, right? So that was really tough. And now the Kohanim are sitting there in an empty Yerushalayim saying, I'd much rather be working Yomam V'Layla. I'd much rather be working around the clock. And the fourth clause that we have over here is Betuloteha Nugot. And Betuloteha, the young girls, the virgins. Okay? And they're very sad. This is an interesting phrase. A lot of the Mefarshim give all sorts of explanations as to why they're sad. Because normally, they would get their shiduchim during that time. But if we want to keep this consistent with what's happening in the rest of this pasuk over here, I imagine that just like today, people come to Yerushalayim. They come. They come to do their korbanot or whatever it is. They're going to eat their korban Pesach or their korban Chagiga. But that only occupies them for a short period of time. What do you do the rest of the day? So there has to be some form of entertainment. So some have suggested that the Betuloteha over here, the unmarried women, they were the ones who would do the entertainment. There were dances or whatever it was. They were busy all the time. When you work in the tourism industry, so you know that you like having your tourists come, but when there are too many, I just finished 4 hours of dancing. Here's another group. I'm exhausted. I need to get off my feet for a little while. But now they're unemployed. So Yirmiyahu uses a different kind of personification over here in Pasuk Daled. He started by comparing Yerushalayim to an almana and then taking her down step by step by step. In Pasuk Daled, he goes and breaks it down. What are the streets of the city saying? What are the gates of the city saying? What are the Kohanim in the city saying? What are the young women saying, right? And then he closes by going back. V'hi, Yerushalayim itself, Marla, and she's just very bitter. Okay, so in these opening psukim, we saw three out of the four opening psukim. Yirmiyahu has done an extraordinary job using his personification to describe what he imagines Yerushalayim would feel, right, if Yerushalayim were alive. And for him, Yerushalayim actually probably was very, very much alive. I'd like to take a look at a couple of other things over here in this perek, just to sort of broaden our picture. We spent a lot of time on personification. There's a phrase that appears in this perek four times. Okay, slight variations each time. It appears in Pasuk Beit. Ein la Menachem. Right? And we saw that a few minutes ago, right, that her friends have all abandoned her. That same phrase comes up, and it's the second one comes up in Pasuk Tet. Slight variation. Ein menachem la. It comes up a third time in the Pei Pasuk. Ein menachem la. And again, I've highlighted that on your screen. And it comes up a fourth time in the Shin Pasuk, the second to last one. Ein menachem li. Okay, we'll talk about the switch in the person in a few minutes. There are four different times. You can even argue that this phrase is the theme phrase of the opening parak. There's nobody here to comfort Yerushalayim. And yet, I think when we take a look at them, we'll actually see that that there are slight differences, not only in the phraseology, but based on the context. That theme phrase takes on different nuance each time it's used. The first time, Ein la menachem mikolo aveha, and we saw that in Pasuk Beit, right? There is nobody to comfort her from all of her friends because kol re'eha bagduva, right? Because all of her friends have abandoned her. They've all betrayed her, right? So literally, there is nobody around to comfort her precisely because they've all abandoned her. That's pretty awful. The second one comes up in Pasuk Tet. And here again, the context gives us a little bit of a different understanding as to why there is nobody there to comfort her. If you take a look at the two words that precede, and again, I've highlighted that in the blue highlighter, the two words that precede Ein Menachem La, Vatered Tla'im, her downfall was just extraordinary. From the word Pele, Tla'im, Pele, right? The equivalent of waking up tomorrow morning and reading the newspaper and discovering that Elon Musk is bankrupt. He has nothing. And he's calling up people, can you lend me? Right? That's Vatered Pla'im. Right? The downfall was just breathtaking. It was a pillar. We've never ever seen anything like that. It was so fast and so dramatic. And it's precisely because Vatered Pla'im that Ein Menachem La. Because often when you're in a bad place, so we can take comfort in knowing that there are others who understand us. And we usually, when we're in a very bad place, so of course, you know, at that moment, we don't think anybody really can understand us, right? Even though we know, right, we know intellectually, rationally, that they've been through similar kinds of things. Everybody's own mourning, everybody's own avilut, everybody's own distress is their own. But knowing that other people have experienced similar things and can empathize or sympathize with us is really, really helpful. But in this case, the fall of Yerushalayim was so dramatic. There was nothing like that. There was nobody who could relate to what that could have possibly meant. And precisely because there was nobody who could relate to that really dramatic fall, Ein Menachem La. There is nobody there who can comfort her. Because even if somebody would want to, there is nobody who can say, I understand, or I think I understand, or I'd like to try to understand. Not possible. The third one, and I'm jumping down now, to the Pei Pasuk. Persat Zion biyadeha Yerushalayim. Zion opens her hands like this. She turns heavenly. Ein menachem la. There is nobody there to comfort her. Siva Hashem liyaakov svivav tzarav. And the reason why there's nobody there to comfort her is because it's Hashem who has brought this upon her. When people are in a bad place, when they've experienced something awful, and when there's nobody that they can turn to, they turn their hands heavenward. They hope, they pray that Hashem hears them, that Hashem is listening to them. And in their darkest moments, they turn to God. But here, Yerushalayim looks around and says, God is the one who did this. Tziva Hashem liYaakov. Hashem is the one who did this. Hashem is the one who brought the enemies. If Hashem is the one who brought the enemies, I can't even turn to him. So Eimen Achimla, that loneliness of that Almana, has just gotten one step even lower. Right? We saw earlier like three or four steps that Yirmiyahu takes the Almana down. But through this Eimen Achim, it goes to a whole different dimension, because now she has nobody to turn to, not in this world and not in the world above. Okay. Before we go to the last one, I want to point something out in terms of the Perek. And with this, I'm going to close the frontal presentation. I'll take a look at the questions that you have. There are 22 psukim in this Perek. It turns out that the Perek divides neatly in half. I'll show you something that might look a little bit confusing. I won't show you that confusing thing, because we're not going to have enough time to make it less confusing. But it turns out that the first half of the Perek is all written in the third person. It's somebody speaking about Yerushalayim. Here is the Navi, the outsider, speaking about Yerushalayim, speaking about Zion, like a reporter on the news. Okay? So he talks about Echaya Shvabadad Ha'ir, that city, look at that city. Bachotiv Ke. She cries. Darchei Zion Avelot, those, Hayut Sareha L'Rosh. Right? It's all about third person. This is an outsider talking about Yerushalayim. It's all in the third person. There's one pasuk that's an exception. That pasuk is pasuk tet. It starts by talking in the third person. Tum ata, her impurity, right? Tum ata b'shulah lo zachra achrita, her end. It's all talking about her, third person. You take a look at the end of Pasuk Tet. Again, highlighted in the blue highlighter. Re'e Hashemet on Yi, Ki Yigdil Oyev. All of a sudden, we have one phrase, and that one phrase is in the first person. And I'm just imagining over here, you have a reporter sitting there describing the events. And let's assume the reporter is a really, really excellent reporter and describing all the things that he or she is seeing, right? And then the reporter finds a survivor and goes and takes the microphone and hands it to the survivor. And you see this person disheveled, their clothes torn, ashes all over them, right? They've been through hell. And he hands them the microphone. And these are people who are not eloquent. They're not great speakers. They don't have the same breadth of language that the reporter has. But the five words that come out of their mouth at that moment can be more powerful than all the eloquence of the reporter. So that's what Yirmiyahu does over here. He's the reporter, right? He's talking about Yerushalayim. Afterwards, he's going to continue talking about Yerushalayim, about Zion. But here he's found a survivor. And he puts the microphone in her mouth. And we hear her voice. Re'e Hashem et oni, ki higdil oyev. God, take a look at my suffering. My enemy has overpowered me. That one phrase from the survivor herself is far, far more powerful than anything that the reporter can say. The interesting thing is that what I just describes the first half of the Perek. Aleph through Chaf. As soon as the first 11 Pasukim, as soon as we get to Pasuk 12, the Lamed Pasuk, The second half of the perek is an inverse of the first half. Everything in the second half of the perek is in the first person. All of a sudden, the reporter loses the microphone. And we hear the survivors' voices. And the entire thing is in the first person, except for one pasuk, right? Except for the pei pasuk with that Ein Menachem La down here. Except for that, everything else is in the first person. Here, the reporter grabs the microphone back for a minute. And afterwards, it goes right back to the first person. Sadiku Hashem ki fihu mariti. I betrayed God. Mariti, I did it. And that continues until the very end of the parak. So we have this mirror imaging. The second half of the parak is literally a mirror image of the first half. The first half is all in the third person with a single pasuk in the first person. The second half is the first person reversing from a single pasuk back to the first person. And in that context, that last Ein Menachem, right, is not the reporter describing. We hear her voice. Ein Menachem Li. And that Ein Menachem Li includes all of the above. When we hear it from Yerushalayim's voice. Okay. I'm going to stop here. I'm going to take a look at the chat. Let's see what questions were, came up in the chat. Okay, I see that somebody actually put the link to the source material. I'm reading here. Gershon Hepner writes, "Poetry is a source of ambiguity. That may be why Bilam's prophecies are so poetic, foreshadowing Echa not only in the verse of Am Levadai Dishkon, a trope that is echoed 11 times in the first chapter of Echa. That badat, very nice." Yudi Thoman asks about my identification of Yirmiyahu as the author. There's a range of scholarship on this about who actually wrote Megillat Echa. Amongst the scholarship, so there are debates as to who wrote it and when exactly it was written. But there's a substantive number of the scholars who believe that Perek Aleph specifically was actually written by Yirmiyah. That's why I use his name here. Okay, another question. How would you explain Yitomim Hayinu Ve'in Av Imotenu Ka'almanot? It's an interesting question, meaning the Almana is used again.
Shvim Ve'ad talk?
See that again?
I said, this is your Yehudi tree. Is it okay if I explain what I'm writing here?
Sure.
Okay, Haitar to Almana doesn't have to be similar to an Almana. It could mean indeed an Almana. In other words, Kafa Imut means to verify something. How can you possibly say Yitomenu Hayinu Ve'en Ab Imotenu Ke Almana means they're similar to Almana? In a Tanakh, if you have no father, that's it. You're a Yatom, okay? That means your mother's an Almana. So there's no reason you have to assume Haitaka Almana means similar. That's drash. Okay, I don't think you're wrong. Drash is fine, but it's not pshat. Pshat means she's indeed a widow, not she is in some way resembles one.
Okay, I I hear what you're saying. Okay, I see a number of other comments here. Later by Shalom Gold, Zatzal used to point up at all the building cranes as a bracha and a sign of Geula. Yes, the popular joke here in Yerushalayim is that the national bird of Israel should be the crane, because we are always under construction of tall buildings. And then two other comments towards the end over here. It feels like we've been living that abandonment since October 7th. Well, I'm trying to stick within understanding Megillat Echa. There are lots of people who have been feeling that abandonment, and lots of people who are working very hard to break that sense of abandonment. One of the things that has been very powerful as somebody who lives here, especially in the early months of the war, was to see the way people banded together. I'm not talking about what was happening officially from the top down, but what was happening in terms of the nation. It was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was, it may have been Anthony Blinken on his first visit here after October 7th, who, or it might have been the chief of staff of the military, of the U.S. military on their first visit here. And they were blown away by the spirit of volunteerism and the resilience of the people. So as much as we want to compare what, Echa and the Churbanot to October 7th, our situation, I believe, is a very, very different situation. We are here, and doesn't mean that everything's good. There's a lot that needs to be fixed. But Am Yisrael has risen to the occasion, and not just Am Yisrael here in Israel. I have to point out, the outpouring of support that came from Am Yisrael all around the world was extraordinary.
Rabbi Shulman yesterday pointed out that the abandonment of Badad reflects the betrayal of the allies of Tzidkiyahu and Jerusalem. It's not just abandoned, it's not just sad, but it reflects a betrayal.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Thank you for that.
That was Rabbi Shulman.
Thank you. And thanks to Rabbi Shulman. Okay, we have, at least on my clock, I think we're supposed, we have 2 minutes left. Yeah. Okay, so thank you. And next week, we're going to take a look at the keynote for the nighttime. We'll take a look at, I believe, two keynotes for the nighttime. And again, looking specifically at the poetry of the keynote, which is going to be similar but quite different than the poetry of Megillat Echa itself. So thank you very much for being here with me, and I look forward to seeing you again next week.
That was very good.
Thank you so much.
Excellent.
Thank you.
And it's good to see some familiar faces and names. Yeah, I'm going to close this session now, and I look forward to. I'm looking at. There's one question here. If the event didn't happen, how is it so graphic, and written in first and third person? I'm not sure why you think the event didn't happen. So there are opinions that say that parts of this were written in Nevuah, were written as prophecy beforehand. So if you're of that opinion, then it obviously was a very vivid Nevuah. I don't think you necessarily have to accept the idea that it was written prior to the event. But even if it was written prior to the event, right, sometimes it's very powerful when somebody writes something like this. He's trying to prevent the event. So he's writing this nevuah so people will read it and be moved. Daf could be moved by the power of that poetry. I'm going to wish everybody a good day or good afternoon or good evening, and look forward to seeing you next week.